This is The Human and the Machine, brought to you by Editorial Intelligence in association with Vodafone.
Welcome to The Human and the Machine. I'm Julia Hobsbawm.
And I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, we'll be looking at
the average teenager today gets their first smartphone when they're 13, spends on average 7 hours a day connected to it. And as a generational cohort, Generation Z, those born between 1996 and 2010, are having less sex, are going out less, are not learning to drive at the same pace and speed as their parents, are taking fewer drugs. What are they doing instead? They are connected constantly on their phones and connecting via social media.
And we'll be discussing
the fears that AI will destroy us all are quite absurd. AI doesn't work well enough for that to happen, nor is there any particular reason to think that AI, when it gets that powerful, if it gets that powerful, will want to destroy us.
As well as our regular features on the best and worst of tech.
I have witnessed many, many arguments between people who are friends on Slack because they've misconstrued something someone has said. So I hate it when people don't use emojis or GIFs.
That's all ahead right here on The Human and the Machine. Stay with us.
Julia, here we are again, and it's all about the generational divide today.
Yes, we're looking at the question of whether the millennials and the Zs are totally different from the baby boomers and the Xs in the way we approach and use and manage technology, or whether, of course, the intergenerational question, Georgina, is does technology, in fact, manage us?
Well, yeah, and I think we're finding increasingly that perhaps it might be, but that's what we're trying to stop. Do you remember, Julia, the days of dial-up before any of this even existed?
I do, but of course my first technological love is probably my last, and that's the telephone.
Let's hear from our guests now. We've got a really great panel and some very, very interesting things to say.
This is The Human and the Machine.
Today's panel discussion is about the generations, the differences between the generations, the millennials, the Zs, the Xs, the Ys. I should say that the combined age of the women, myself included, around the podcast panel table is over 150. I'm sorry to tell you the terrible truth. I'm not going to tell you how that shakes down, but I have with me Timandra Harkness, the writer, broadcaster and presenter who knows everything there is to know about big data and manages to make it intelligible and funny. We have Eliza Philby, the historian who has made it her business to explain to us where we've been and where we're going in terms of the new generational divides, and Dolly Alderton, who herself is a celebrity podcaster. She has just written the most extraordinary memoir, including What It's Like to Be a Teenager. Dolly, tell us about you. What have you written?
I've written a memoir called Everything I Know About Love, which, because I used to be a dating columnist for the Sunday Times Style, I think some people have come to it assuming it's going to be Carrie Bradshaw tales of dates and martinis, which there are none, basically. And it's more of a growing up memoir. It's about growing up in part on the internet and how that's affected me as a millennial. It's about going through my 20s, and it's mainly about kind of female friendship.
I should say that actually one of the things that struck me about reading this memoir is that you're not so keen on the virtues of online dating, and neither am I. I mean, I missed that period, really, because I've been married for hundreds of years. But it's not all it's cracked up to be, is it, online dating?
Do you know, I'm really in two minds about it, because I think I really got a fatigue with it because I was doing it week in, week out. It was like, I always say Tinder to a dating columnist is like a human Lakeland catalogue, where it's just like you were ordering every week what you needed. And it's not a great way to think about humans, I have to say. And I think without realising on an unconscious level, there was a conglomeration in my head of this thing that's meant to be the most magical and nuanced thing, which is romance and getting to know individuals. And I was seeing it more as like a kind of shopping experience of what need I had and who could gratify me.
So very, very transactional.
Yes, yeah. But equally, I'm often asked this question about how I feel about online dating and the future of dating at events. And at every event I've done in the last 2 weeks, I've said how many people here know a couple who have moved in together or who've got married, who met on Tinder. And it's always the majority of the room put their hand up. So, I think that's wonderful.
You open your memoir with a very powerful love affair, not with a person, but with technology. What was that technology? Tell us about it.
It was MSN Messenger, which I think is now defunct, actually. I think it's like talking to Gen Z about this. It will be like talking about papyrus and hieroglyphics. It was like an instant messenger. It was very crude. I don't think you could even send images on it or files. It was just a very small, normally pixelated avatar. And it was just a back and forth instant messaging service.
And you discovered it, and what difference did it make to your life?
Well, it changed everything for me. I think I was at an all-girls school. I was very bored. I grew up in the suburbs, and it was my first interactions with boys were on MSN. And tracing back when I went into therapy, which is something that I write about in the book, in my late 20s, I was trying to trace back why I had these issues relating to men. And I've got to say, I really did see the starting point as being MSN, which is why I wrote about it, about me becoming at a young age, about 13, becoming very comfortable being in a virtual space with a stranger where I curated who I was and presented it in a certain way and felt like I was getting very close to them. But in fact, it was two people of the opposite sex just not being able to relate or connect to each other.
Although you do describe rather beautifully the feeling of connection, albeit imperfect and virtual, as like finding a blade of grass on Mars.
Yeah, that's all retrospective. I feel like it was intensity rather than intimacy. But at the time, it really did feel like I was finding human life for the first time. It felt like I was really connecting for the first time. It was hugely exciting.
Eliza, what's different? It feels like everything is different and nothing is different, that we're moving along at such a pace. Is today's Generation Z experiencing connection like Dolly?
Yes, I think what's changed and what's different is the intensity. There was that wonderful moment where you connected to dial-up internet and you downloaded MSN Messenger. Whereas for the average teenager today, gets their first smartphone when they're 13, spends on average 7 hours a day connected to it. And as a generational cohort, Generation Z, those born between 1996 and 2010, are having less sex, are going out less, are not learning to drive at the same pace and speed as their parents, are taking fewer drugs. What are they doing instead? They are connected constantly on their phones and connecting via social media. So yes, I think that desire to connect, and as Dolly referenced, you know, to find a place of one's own when you're a teenager and you're growing up, is absolutely still there. But I think for this generation is that much more intense and that much more accessible.
Do you think that teenagers use social media so avidly precisely because so much of the teenage years in some shape or form is pervaded by loneliness or an inferiority complex or a finding your way, and becoming that blade of grass on Mars is a moment of recognition? Tim Andred, what was it like when you were a teenager and you didn't have anybody to dial up?
This is interesting because obviously, where I think mentally setting this virtual interaction against some golden age of when teenagers were just together in real life all the time. But I spent a fair amount of my teenage years living in the deepest countryside, where the nearest friend was a good half hour walk away. You know, or I could get my push bike and go to the pub, which was 3 miles away. So although there was a definite divide between time when I was interacting with my friends and time when I wasn't, I think maybe that's the main difference. But it wasn't as if I was constantly in this great, we were all together all the time and we had this real life face-to-face interaction. And okay, I mean, maybe rural life is a bit different, but it's not necessarily better or worse now. I think it's just different. And interestingly, I think this is one of the few cases where the change in technology really has facilitated a very different way of social interaction.
I think it's rewired our brains. I think it's even more fundamental than that. I mean, there was a very famous article written last year by Jean Twinge in The Atlantic, where she said, you know, how smartphones have destroyed a generation. And her starting point was, if you look at all the statistics involving depression amongst the youth, they shoot up as soon as the iPhone becomes basically widespread and is owned by 50% of America's teenage youth. And she's connected directly that link between the role of social media and the rise of not only depression, but the rise of teenage suicide, which now outpaces teenage homicide. So more people are killing themselves than are killing each other. So I think what's quite interesting is there is a connection, I think, between depression and social media. But if we push further at that, I think it's also rewiring our brains. I mean, the average Generation Zer has an attention span of 8 seconds, and it's decreasing in every generation. But what's fundamental is how they're using that 8 seconds. You ever watch a teenager use their phone? They have multi-apps in play. They're consuming so much information in such a short space of time. It's what they're doing in those 8 seconds, which is, I think, truly impressive.
Dolly, what about depression and teenagers?
I think as a millennial, I come from this quite a unique experience. Such a millennial thing to say. I'm really special, guys.
You actually write about the millennials in your book as being the self generation, not so much the selfie, but self-obsessed generation.
Oh, I'm entirely self-obsessed. As in, I'm not a bad person, I'm not an uncompassionate person, but something that I've really noticed, I think I've got a problem with my phone. And I think I'll look back on this period of my life as a time where I was fully addicted. I do think that I'll recover from it at some point. But something that I notice is I think about myself all the time. And I've noticed it a lot with promoting a book, where all I'm doing is kind of checking my email and putting out reviews or promoting it on Instagram and Twitter. And I recently realised, I was like, I'm in an echo chamber of self, in my thoughts, in my interior world, and it's so depressing. And I need to actively make a decision to ingest something that's not my own life.
So isn't this part of the problem, that the ability to communicate has been amplified and accelerated and made super, super easy, that you can download apps for free and that you are encouraged to share, to share, to share, to communicate? But where does the learning, where does the experience happen? Timandra, you're a data cruncher. Is there any data on this? What's going on about how new technologies of rivers of information is it making us smarter, or is it just making us depressed?
Well, this is the thing. You could argue, I think, that a lot of what it's doing is giving us access to information, and that when the teenagers are doing what I cannot possibly do, which is watch TV and have three tabs open and do all this at once, that they are actually processing a lot of information. I think one thing that really has changed, and this is where I'm not sure it comes back to the technology. I mean, you were talking about self-promotion, but that's a normal thing for an author to do. When my book came out, I was obsessively tweeting absolutely the most tenuous links to things in the book.
Was it all that you were thinking about?
Yes, so your book is because about you. I had a book.
Yeah, it's a perpetuating.
Yeah, exactly. The thing is, your book is about you, so it slides into yourself. But I think what's interesting now is that I have, because in the past, when I started using social media and social media came out, I was a stand-up comedian. So I had a very distinct thing in my mind of, this is public me. This is the me that goes on stage and tells jokes. Now, the illusion is that that's just me. But of course it's not. It's a persona. And then there's private me, which is my private life. But what I think is different is it's quite hard now to make that distinction. And if you've grown up where your social life with your friends takes place on social media, then it's quite hard to draw that line.
But I think teenagers today are actually much more cautious and much more aware of the downsides of digital and social media. And therefore, I think, have a much healthier relationship to tech than perhaps their parents' generation. They prefer, for example, Snapchat over Facebook and Twitter because Snapchat disappears. They have a private and public Instagram account. Most of their true self, if you like, is revealed on WhatsApp, which is contained and who you actually show that to. They have a filter that older generations don't. So the generation that posts most on Facebook and uploads the most to Facebook are the over 50s because they have no digital filter.
No.
You ever look at a 19-year-old upload a photograph on social media, they will upload one and it'll be perfectly polished.
But that's exactly it. That's public. That's the way that I would, if I'm tweeting about a book, I will think, what impression is this going to give? Who's my audience for this? I'm thinking like a broadcaster, like a publisher about that. And that's a healthy thing to do when you're promoting your work. But I don't think it is a healthy thing to do when you're interacting socially with your friends. I think it's too mediated. I think there's too much, what impression am I giving? We're making a radio program about the future of fashion. And one of the things I've found is all these apps that will basically edit and filter your selfies and change the way you look. I mean, they're especially popular in the Far East, where they make your face whiter, your chin more pointy, and your eyes bigger. And it's like, well, I thought the whole point of a selfie was, hey, I'm just spontaneously reacting. But no, it's all about
your
giving
best self.
The right impression.
So, Eliza, I would challenge that view you've just put about the idea that the older generation is doing more unfiltered sharing than the younger generation. I think you're right that they are, as Timandra says, producing a more sculpted, manufactured image of themselves, hence the private and the public. But it's just different formats, really, of the same sense of sharing, which is they are continuously posting. Is it relevant that the posts are disappearing rather than staying with high privacy settings?
I think it is, because if you're 20 in 2018, your digital footprint stretches right back to 10 years. So their entire adolescence is online. And as you're about to enter the job market, you are overly cautious and conscious of the kinds of things that are now available to potential employers. They are just much more aware of, firstly, what's online, firstly, how to get rid of it, and then secondly, how to have a much healthier attitude towards tech. So the whole fear of missing out phenomenon, which is synonymous with millennials, is now actually the younger generation are now all about digital detoxes and looking up and unplugging and searching out authentic experiences. And yes, they'll potentially share them out, but the lived experience and the real experience is, I think, now taking much more currency. With the younger generation, because they're just that much more conscious of tech. And they see themselves, just final point, as a brand. So they're very difficult to market to, very difficult to advertise to, because they have been curating and collating material and their brand since they were teenagers.
Dolly, I'm going to give the last word to you, because what struck me about your memoir is that unlike my generation, where the technology was the television or the telephone, your technology was, let's call it texting, as a sort of rounded up version. And yet everything you write about is about relationships and the difference between, in fact, what you rightly call intimacy or intensity.
Yeah, I think going back to what I was boasting about my unique perspective as a millennial, what I was referencing there is the fact that my childhood was spent half in intense virtual life and half none at all. So I've had the experience of both. And I think the difference maybe between the generation below me and millennials is I think millennials have got to a point where their virtual life, their virtual interactions, their friendships on WhatsApp, their sexting, their intimacy and intensity with strangers from Tinder, their experiences through social media was more meaningful than their real life experiences. And I'm not saying that's everyone. It certainly happened to me. And I think that we're now at a point of examining that and shifting it back around, because I've read a quote the other day that said the internet used to be the place you went to escape real life, and now real life is the place you go to escape the internet.
Very well put. Well, I thoroughly recommend Dolly Alderton's memoir, Everything I Know About Love. Eliza Philby, who is the go-to person for anyone organising a conference or a briefing on what the generations after mine are thinking, and Timandra Harkness, who communicates so brilliantly about all things digital. Thank you all very much indeed.
Thank you.
This is The Human and the Machine.
This podcast is sponsored by Vodafone. If you'd like to know more about previous podcasts and the symposiums we do on The Human and the Machine, please go to thehumanandmachine.com.
This is The Human and the Machine, brought to you by Editorial Intelligence, in association with Vodafone.
In a moment, we'll listen to the conversation I had with Parag Khanna, a leading global geostrategist, senior research fellow at the National University of Singapore and author of many books, including the best-selling Connectography.
But before we hear from Parag, we're going to our regular examination of the best and worst of tech with our Techno Heaven, Hell and Shabbat. Well, let's start with
Techno Hell.
I'm Hannah Such and I'm a co-founder of a walking app called Go Jauntly. My techno hell is people who don't use emojis when they're messaging you, because I find it really hard to understand tone of voice sometimes. And I have witnessed many, many arguments between people who are friends on Slack because they've misconstrued something someone has said. So I hate it when people don't use emojis or GIFs.
That was Hannah Such. She took part in our panel discussion in a previous episode, which, of course, you can always access through our website. And now it's time for us to cross to our one-on-one interview. Julia Hobsbawm with our guest.
I am delighted to be joined on his global travels by a polymath, Parag Khanna, a fellow of the Lee Kuan Yew School in Singapore, a PhD from LSE, recent academician of the Robert Bosch Academy in Berlin, born in India, raised in Abu Dhabi, New York, and now residing in Singapore. He is the author of many books, including the very acclaimed book on connectography, the geographical connections around our borders. And he joins me today in London to talk about what else, the human and the machine in the context of connectedness. Parag, hello, welcome. What I want to talk about is really connectedness and what you call connectivity in a geographical framework, which is, we're a big, big, wide world. What's going on with connectedness in that big, wide world? Right. Just start to tell me where you're coming from.
Right. To me, connectivity is a permanent part of the human condition. It's just a question of degree. I interpret in my work connectivity as something that's really intrinsic to human nature. And I explicitly say that in order to provide an antidote to the idea that we are inherently tribal in nature. You know, the first thing that we've done since mankind wandered out of Africa is look for other human communities to connect to. We build roads, we use tools, we communicate using whether it's carrier pigeons or horseback. It's always to connect and communicate. The reason that diplomacy is joked to be the second oldest profession, right, after you know what, is because of our desire to be communicating with neighboring communities or as far as possible. So it's not that we've been fighting savage wars of tribalism for all of human history. The one thing that we've absolutely been doing for all of human history is building physical connections to each other's communities. That is absolutely as deep, if not deeper, a part of who we are. And so there is no connectivity, though, without an infrastructure. So what I do in my work is to make it as physical as possible. I talk about the highways, the railways, the oil and gas pipelines, electricity grids, and most of all, now the newest layer of connectivity, and it is just the newest, and it's the fiber optic internet cables and telephony and what that does to human connectivity.
And what you call rather wonderfully the nervous system,
yes,
of society.
Right.
It's really only 150 years old, this interconnectedness, yes, since the world of cabling,
right,
really joined up the infrastructure and the transport networks and became the communication networks. What impact has that had on the world, that very, very recent nanosecond in history, on connectedness that has been global?
Right. I think it has a quantum leap of an impact, because there's the long-term view and the more cautious view that says, it was ever thus. We're simply accelerating and making more convenient the kinds of connections that existed for 150 years with the telegraph, you know, and that did not necessarily prevent war. It didn't prevent misunderstanding. And here we're in the same situation again. Things are happening faster, but it's not changing the nature of things. What's different, though, is that today, because of the collective conversation that can take place with the scale and the density and the depth of inclusiveness of the connectivity in communication, this global nervous system, such as it is, you can actually speak about the emergence of certain sets of global values and norms that you would never have said existed in the mid-19th century or the mid-20th century. Today, when you interview young people from all across the world, from countries rich and poor, people who have migrated or never migrated, never traveled outside their home country, you will find that they prize connectivity as something of a human right. Mobility, again, whether or not they have done it, they feel that it is a human and right. Ecological consciousness, whether or not their country is in a state of environmental peril or not. A set of global norms has emerged amongst youth globally across society that could only have been possible because of this intensity of the global conversation.
But what is interesting to me is what you said a couple of minutes ago about the imperfectness and the limits, actually, of this hyperconnectedness, which is mistakes are still made, right. Miscom happens. And I would lay the blame at exactly that speed and scale. I would lay the blame at exactly the speed and scale that is so venerated. So on the one hand, you have a younger generation that now takes it, as you say, really as a human right to be connected constantly. But you also have an aging class of baby boomers and Generation X's and people in positions around the world, if you like, the establishment, who don't seem to understand that what drives the human is intimacy. What do you feel about that?
I'd like to think that life as one gets older is a process of trial and error, and you're learning along the way. We're seeing how young people were reckless about their privacy, and now they're logging off Facebook, and they're saying, you know, I can't believe I allowed so much of my data and images of myself to be out there in public. I want to delete, you know, my account now. I used to share my password with my boyfriend or girlfriend. I would never do that today. So this maturation process that people of all generations, but especially young people, have been going through.
But do you not still feel that the generation that is, if you like, still ruling the world? I mean, I'm not talking about the much sought after demographic of new consumers and new workers, but I'm talking about the people that still fundamentally run the institutions who are over kind of 40 years old. They still believe that if you reach millions of people very, very fast, that's better than small conurbations of trust-based communities, right? Isn't capitalism predicated on speed and scale and growth?
No doubt that some of the communications infrastructure we've laid down has the intent of reaching mass audiences. Why are telecom companies spending trillions of dollars to lay down fiber optic cables across the Pacific Ocean so that they can capture data streams and deliver data services to billions of customers in Asia and reap the financial rewards from that? And then that has social implications in how these individuals behave and then how they relate to their governments, how they relate to global capitalism as a whole, and where their corporate and other kinds of affinities and loyalties lie. I think, though, that this generation that runs the institutions is not entirely cohesive, right? It doesn't actually have one view in the same way that youth don't and elderly don't. Whenever I catch myself saying, oh, those old dinosaurs, I remember, wait a minute, there's this guy called Bill Gates, right? And he's elderly and he's pretty on the cutting edge of technology, right? And so for every Warren Buffett who doesn't own a mobile phone and see the use and need for one, there's a Bill Gates. So we can't generalize that much.
And yet my concern remains that the way the human being organizes in society is often at a slower pace, at less scale. And maybe even calling it capitalism is the wrong way to describe the it of the way the world functions on commerce and trade and growth. But something is out of balance, is it not? Is that not a concern for you?
And I think what you're rightly referring to isn't capitalism, but capital. And capital has many different, you know, forms and meanings and instantiations. And one of them is social capital. And, you know, you rightly refer to the intimate nature of social bonds as an extremely important form of capital. And as you well know, there's lots of work in social science around the importance of that local social capital. My work is about what I call global social capital. You know, and there's a chapter on that in Connectography where I say, you know, what the internet has done, what the web has done, what social media communications tools have done is enable the rise of a certain kind, a veneer, if that's all it is at this point in time, of global social capital. And I refer to examples that anyone can relate to, like being able to Skype with someone in China or Russia and take a language class with them. You can even learn to play the violin from someone on the other side of the world just by getting on Skype with them. And so there is this emergence of bonds, transnational bonds, that again challenge the idea that the most important kind of community or social capital is that which you happen to have born into, the family that you immediately have, right? But because you can develop deep, important, lasting bonds that are not related to blood or family, but that can really speak to you, right? So you can develop an affiliation, a loyalty to causes, to environmentalism, feminism, you know, human rights, wide across borders in the world, just by leveraging the reality of this global social capital.
And having values that put checks and balances on behavior. I mean, we're recording this interview on the 10th anniversary of the financial crash. The World Bank
published a report with Amartya Sen and Joseph Stiglitz after that crash, in which they said putting social capital at the heart of restructuring and recovery is crucial. How much of that has really happened in the last 10 years, would you say?
Well, you really have to look at different examples around the world. In the United States, median income, which is a far more important measure of overall national welfare, has declined. Per capita average income has gone up because the top 1% and top 10% have magnificently increased their wealth in the past decade. But the median income has fallen, which is a really deeply disturbing statistic. So social inclusiveness also has been lagging from where it ought to be in, ironically, the social welfare-oriented societies of Europe, because you've seen austerity measures in the past decade that have been very, very negative. You've contracted economies rather than helping the large mass of people, the bottom 50%, to have the disposable income and the financial security that they need to be included in the economic and even in the social and political structure. Things have not gone well in the last decade. Particularly in Anglo-Saxon economies, though also the austerity applied to Southern Europe as well.
I'd like to wrap up this sadly all too short interview with you, Parag, by talking about geography. I think you are covering some of the most interesting bases around this question of borders and connectedness geographically. And I specifically want you to frame that in relation to data, because data is borderless, but the world is still very bordered. Tell me about your ideas on how big and how small the world is now.
It is incredible, the volume and the speed of data flows and transactions around the world, right? If you look at not just anymore at companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon and so forth, but also their Chinese and their Asian competitors, you clearly see that all of them, and again, they may compete with each other, but what they do for us is actually multiply opportunities and channels of data flows and transactions that we can participate in globally, right? So we do have an enormous volume of data flow and knowledge flow and information flow and capital flow around the world. Each of us does have more access to more information than ever before and more opportunities. Going back to global social capital, I write about this global mobile workforce, right? So people who log onto Upwork. Upwork is actually the world's largest employer in many ways, right? It's a platform that tens of millions of people log onto, and me personally and my wife have employed people in Ukraine, in Libya, in Malaysia, and people are able to work. They're able to do digital work. They're able to get paid a higher wage than they could ever earn locally, and they can earn for their families. And you actually develop a bond with those people. I have hired and contributed to the family welfare of people who I will never meet just because of that digital connectivity. So it has a very positive impact for many people.
Parag Khanna, thank you.
This is the Human and the Machine. We've heard what Hannah Such believes to be her techno hell, but what about the opposite? Here she is again.
Techno heaven.
Hi, I'm Hannah Such, and I'm a co-founder of a walking app called Go Jauntly. And my techno heaven is Google Docs. So Google Docs has allowed me to collaborate with all of my co-workers, my husband, my family, and it means that we can write, make, ideate, scribble, all sorts of stuff together. We get to keep the history of the work that we've done, and it saves a hell of a lot of time. I couldn't live without Google Docs for collaborative working.
Techno heaven.
Julia, this week you've also been to see Nathan Myhrvold. Tell us about him.
Nathan Myhrvold is the former chief technology officer of Microsoft, and he is spreading the message that technology is not necessarily going to set us free, but it's not to be feared. He was in town where I caught up with him to give a lecture about AI, and he's really comparing those of us, myself included, who are nervous about the march of the machines. He's really comparing us to Luddites, the 19th century loom makers who smashed up their factories. But Nathan is not without human feeling, as you're going to find out. I was really very, very lucky to catch him.
Well, let's hear that conversation.
Technologies like artificial intelligence have enormous promise and incredible potential, but they've also scared people. And some of those fears perhaps are worthy, but mostly I think it's a bunch of bollocks.
Are you saying that our fears are exaggerated, or that they are misplaced, or that, what are you saying?
The fears that AI will destroy us all are quite absurd. AI doesn't work well enough for that to happen, nor is there any particular reason to think that AI, when it gets that powerful, if it gets that powerful, will want to destroy us. So I think that they're both exaggerated. But in the short term, the issue is not destroying us all, it's taking all of our jobs. And I think that's greatly exaggerated too. And I think that because there's been a long history of people fearing that a new technology would destroy jobs, and so far it's never happened. I think the same thing's true here.
Your Tacitus lecture here in London makes reference to the 19th century Luddites. Do you feel that anybody that questions AI as anxiously as many do are effectively 21st century Luddites?
Well, the Luddites made the connection between a new technology at the time of something called a stocking frame that lets you knit stockings much faster, and the fact that they would become unemployed. And it turns out they were dead wrong, because they were in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, and they happened to have been from Nottingham. That was the golden era of Nottingham, when, in fact, the unemployment was lower, standards of living continued to rise for most of the 19th century. It was actually a great time, yet they had been afraid of it. And I think a lot of people who talk about the jobs that will be destroyed by AI and have that concern are making the same error. They focus on, well, one element of the system, say, oh my God, what if truck drivers have no jobs because self-driving trucks take them? Without considering that, first of all, that's many years off, decades off probably. And second, the same technology that creates that thing they see as a harm affects the whole system. And the whole system tends to adapt very well.
I'd like to talk a bit about the whole system, as in the whole global system. You made a very interesting point that Africa leapfrogged from no phone to cell phone without the landline. What changes around the world have we been seeing, particularly in developing economies, around the use of technology, where the normal chain that we've seen in the developed world has been broken and altered?
Of course, the lot of many people in Africa is still quite poor. There are 2 billion people that live on a couple dollars a day of income. But there's also never been more opportunity for people in the developing world, both through access to the internet and through other technologies, vaccines and so forth. The standard of living is going up there. And I think the way you have to view this is that our best hope for them achieving a good standard of living is technology. It's not a problem. It's actually a large part of the answer.
Is it also the case that not just in terms of geopolitical changes around the use of tech, but in areas such as medicine, certain machine functions, machine learning functions, are improving our lives in a way that the physical human can't? I note your work in cervical cancer treatment.
Yes. We've developed a system that diagnoses cervical cancer in a minimally invasive way and does it way better than human experts. So that's important for two reasons. One is, in the developed world, it's an easier, cheaper test that helps relieve some of the cost burden that the healthcare system is under in every country in the world. I don't think there's any place that doesn't have that as an issue. But even more important, it allows us to diagnose cervical cancer in the developing world, where there really is no alternative. It's not a question of, is this better than the human expert? Is this better or cheaper than the existing lab? There is no lab. There is no expert. In that context, I think it's enormously valuable. I know that there are people working on many other cancers with similar intent, that we can democratize access to healthcare expertise, not by waiting till we train thousands or millions more doctors, but by doing it with technology.
So you are very much on the plus side of the balance sheet around optimism for tech. Tell me, when you make bread, you've just written a 6-volume book on bread, Do you use a machine or do you use your hands?
Well, it depends on how much time I have. Machines do the job faster, and machines can do the job a little more reliably if you haven't made a lot of loaves of bread. I can make a decent loaf with my hands, but if you want me to make a lot of bread, or if I had to do it every day, I'd use machines.
But what is the former chief technology officer of Microsoft at the time when Microsoft really led the way in so much of the computing capacity and knowledge that we're still seeing today? What has made you write the largest volume ever published on bread?
10 years ago, I started writing big cookbooks. My previous book, Modernist Cuisine, and then Modernist Cuisine at Home, were the largest cookbooks ever written. And it's because I love cooking. But I also love science. And I think there has been a role for me and my team to look at cooking from a fresh light and explain how it works, as well as how you can use it and use both some of our technical insights and maybe some gadgets to do a better job.
Nathan Myhrvold. Julia, setting up this programme, it can be quite difficult to contact you between Friday and Monday, and that's because you're pretty rigorous about switching off from technology. Why is that?
Well, as we heard earlier on in the programme, there really isn't a person who doesn't worry about their use of technology, and being permanently connected struck me as being a problem. And so I decided to impose a diet, really, of intake of social media and the internet and email. And so I, broadly speaking, impose that on weekends, although, of course, I fall off the wagon. I have to say, I feel pretty terrible when I do. So Techno Shabbat, which has become a feature of our programme, as you know, is really because we all crave it in some way. You could argue it's become the new religion. How do you find yourself again if you're not finding a God? How do you find yourself again when you're switching off the cacophony of voices that we play endlessly in our social media and our digital feeds?
And now for Techno Shabbat.
I'm Carl Miller, and I have to admit that I have no digital detox. I have to tell the truth here. I really am connected to the digital world all the time, and I haven't actually really ever made a serious attempt to disconnect myself from it. It's terrible. Even I love to go walking, and I'm on there tweeting about all the things that I see. I have no Techno Shabbat yet.
And you can hear more from Carl in one of our previous episodes. In fact, we're building up quite an archive, and you can check it out on our website.
That's it for this edition of The Human and the Machine. Many thanks to our guests, Timandra Harkness, Dolly Alterton, Eliza Philby, Parag Khanna, and Nathan Myhrvold. If you'd like to know more about anything discussed, head to our website, thehumanandmachine.com.
This show is brought to you by Editorial Intelligence and supported by Vodafone. It was recorded at Spiritland in London's King's Cross. The researcher is Alice Fielden. The studio producer is George McDonough. The executive producer is Julia Hobsbawm. And I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.